History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then to invest enough time to patiently listen as memories from decades ago bring us new perspective in the here and now. This weekend, of course, brings Mother's Day, and over the years we've met some pretty special moms on this program. Since we've focused almost exclusively on the World War II era, we've met WAX and WAVES and WASPs and SPARS, even a few of the first woman Marines. Also, some of those Rosie the Riveters who contributed so powerfully on the home front. My grandmother worked as a civilian at a military installation during that era, and the amazing mother with whom I was blessed was an Army nurse during the Vietnam era before I was born. So, Mom, if you're listening today, thank you for your service and happy Mother's Day. And maybe you're starting to figure out this is going to be a special Mother's Day edition of the program. The mother we have the privilege of meeting was recognized by both the Air Force and the Navy nearly 50 years ago for her selfless actions in the wake of a tragedy in Vietnam. 88-year-old Thelma Wiley of Sacramento, California is our guest. We're going to hear how she survived the tragic Operation Baby Lift plane crash in Vietnam on April 4, 1975. But let's start way back in rural Georgia, where she grew up in a very large family and learned some powerful lessons.
My brother, oldest brother, married. I think he was around 21. The lady he chose for his wife was 18. That was in 41. Daddy moved from Mitchell County, Georgia, to Colquitt. The owner of the farm was very honest, and Dad made quite a bit of money. And he was able to buy two farms. One was maybe small, 150 acres, and maybe 90 acres, something like that. In 1942, my brother and my sister-in-law had their first child, a girl, Betty. Betty was born, I think it was April 29th, and I had 2 months left before I would be eight. Well, I was the babysitter. I had my sister that was almost 4 years old. She didn't help at all. My brother, youngest brother, was 15 months, and Betty was somewhere around 3 months when I started taking care of her. So in addition, I had to wash the breakfast dishes, and the noonday dishes were huge. I was afraid that if I didn't have them all cleaned up by the time they got home from the field, I might get a whipping. So I kept complaining about I had too much to do. I was so small I had to stand on something to wash the dishes. And, you know, I had to have breaks, and when they're crying and changing the diaper and making the bottles. So I guess my dad got tired of me complaining. One day at noon, he said, "Okay, Thelma, Feeney," that was Dorothy, "is going to stay here and take care of the babies this afternoon, and you're going to the field." And at that time, they were shaking peanuts. You know what shaking peanuts mean?
Tell us all about it. Most people have never shaken a peanut before.
Well, the peanuts, they have vines, and the nuts grow in the soil. When it's time to harvest them, like the hottest part of the year, in a humidity like Georgia, some of the vines weren't totally plowed. They would have a light plow to run under the nuts. So you had to pull them up. So Daddy, when we got to the field, Daddy showed me how to do it. Pick up this vine and you shake the rest of the dirt off of it. And then you stack the vines together with the peanuts so they would later be made into a huge stack and let them dry before they get the nuts off and make hay with the vine. So we got there, and Daddy always had two or three rows for himself. He was a fast mover. And I had one row, and he said, "You better be at the end when I get there." So I struggled, and it was so hot and sweaty and dirt just flying all over you. When he got to the end, I was so afraid. And he started meeting me. I was about three quarters of the way down. That's the first time I did that. And he met me. He said, "Now, go home." Sometimes with young people, they have to experience something before they understand.
So your perspective changed a little bit that day?
Yes, I didn't complain anymore about it. It was hot, but in the shade was better than out in the field. So I guess Daddy saw how I performed. Well, some more babies came along, and I was 11 when I started going to the field. And my sister, that was 4, took over the babysitting. And Daddy gave me a mule pulling a rake. He went from one end to the other, showing me how to do it. Then he left. And it was so much dust flying up over you, because, and it was peanuts that just breaking the soil coming out, and that rake would give them energy to come on and grow.
Just out of curiosity, today, do you like peanuts or not?
Oh, yeah, I like peanuts. But, you know, that lifestyle, it developed a lot of character and strength, and you know how to work. You don't mind working. But if I had to do it again, I don't want to do it anymore. My grandson likes to grow things, and he said, I guess I inherited my farming from Graham. I said, no, you didn't. I said, Graham didn't like farming. Anyway, Daddy loved it.
Well, and can you give us a taste of how different things were in those years in the South? Did you get a feel for maybe what your parents and grandparents had endured? And what were some of the things that you dealt with yourself?
I learned to drive the car at 12 years old. I'd go somewhere with my mother, and it's parked on a level plane, and I knew I wouldn't roll. The car wouldn't roll. I would get behind the wheel and shift the gears, and it was, I guess it was 3 gears. But anyway, one Sunday, she went to talk to the owners of this other little farm. Daddy sent her to negotiate, and I said, Mother, can I go with you? And she said, come on. So she talked to the people for a while, and on the way home, I was so scared to ask her. I said, Mother, can I drive? She didn't say anything. She just pulled over to the side and stopped. And she slid from under the wheel to the passenger side, and I ran around and got under the wheel and started the car up and put it in gear. And she started to tell me, now. I said, Mother, don't tell me. I know how to do it. And Mother was so excited. When we got home, she was walking really fast. And she went in the house and said, Jim, you know that gal can drive? And I didn't have to show her a thing. So I was looking at my other sister, and, you know, she was rolling her eyes at me. But anyway, Mother was very young when she married Daddy, and Daddy was quite old. He was 24 when she was born. She was 14 when they married. So, I mean, they married young girls back then. Anyway, Mother was going to normal school to be a home economics teacher. That was a form of college back there. And I think it first came out of England, then Canada. And they changed the name to State Teachers College. Grandmother, I guess she saw Daddy was a catch because he had an automobile. She sent Daddy to get Mother. And when Mother came home, Grandmother wouldn't let her go back. After a while, she and Daddy married. Mother was, she sacrificed a lot for us. She died at 47 from diabetes. I had another year of high school, and my sister that I'm next to, 3 years difference, she was there at the house to take care of the home while I was away, but I drove to school every day. Before that, Mother would board us. She would take us over so we could live in town with someone, little Pelham, Georgia, which was very small, but all of us graduated from high school there. She sacrificed the cost of insulin for our pay to stay over. We would take our food with us to cook. She would pay our board and deny herself. She was a beautiful seamstress, had very good taste and style and colors. Daddy married again, but at that time, my husband, the first husband that I came to California to be with, we had married, and when he came, got ready to go to the military, we married before he left.
And don't talk about anything you don't want to talk about here, but can you give us a sense of, I mean, I didn't live it. I've heard stories from people who lived in those parts, but, you know, there are stories of discrimination, of being treated differently because of the color of your skin. Are there some examples of things you experienced that you can share with us to give us that perspective?
One particular thing to share, and it made my soul cry, those feelings I felt. There was a store where they had just about everything the rural people needed, and sometimes, like, if you didn't have the money, you had an account till money comes in and you pay. And mother gave me a list to go up and do a little shopping. And I gave the list to the person. He was getting all the things to put on the counter so he could ring them up. Another white man came in. He pushed all of my stuff aside and told me to step back. And he waited on this other man. This other person got what he wanted and to ring it up. And then I could go back up to the desk. Anytime you went to the store and you were being helped, you had to step back and let the white person take your place and get theirs first. And another thing, I saw my dad. Dad seemed to have gotten along well with those prejudiced people, but I saw how he kissed up and laughed and how his face looked when he turned his back. But he felt that he needed to do that, I guess, to get along. And, you know, when I did some research on ancestry, there were two dates for Dad's birth. It was Christmas Day on both, but the years were 1880 and 1883. So the 1881 was the one that made him 107, and he died from melanoma.
You're giving us a real picture of how you experienced things. Do you remember having some hopes or dreams or ambitions of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life someday?
I didn't have any. It was so difficult, but I didn't lose hope. But I was always thought about how I can get there. Having Judy, and then when we separated, a single parent, it's hard on single parents, and I just had one. When I came to California, I mean, there were some situations that was just as bad as in Georgia. I was downtown Sacramento, and I was going down J Street. There was a pretty large restaurant, and I used to go down, and I kind of got my mom's skills of sewing. And outing is to go down and look at the fabric and decide the piece I'm going to get next, and I'll get the pattern. I always liked Vogue. Then when I had the money, I'd go and get the materials. So I needed something to eat, and I went in, and they just told me right out, we don't serve Negroes. And down maybe 15th and T, I was looking for an apartment, and they told me we don't rent to Negroes. That was in 61, a couple of years after I came.
I think that's really hard for anybody that hasn't experienced that to understand what that must really feel like. But how did you process those kind of moments without just lashing out in anger?
My soul cries in situations like that. It is so painful, especially when you can't do anything about it. I had applied at McClellan. By the time I went to McClellan to take the test, my fingers were flying because I had worked for a franchise tax.
So that's how your journey toward this incredible moment in your life we're going to talk about with Operation Baby Lift, it started by getting a job at McClellan Air Force Base?
Yes. And it also started, I don't know what term to use, but it was encouraged by prejudice, I feel.
Because you saw they would not promote you to a better job.
They took away the promotion I had to a better job and wouldn't release me to continue it because I had an opportunity to be transferred to that classification. But the supervisor over there, he said, yes, I have an opening, but your present supervisor has to release you. And he told me he wouldn't release me. Then I saw the outlet by going to Vietnam. That was a long way to travel to get a promotion.
And it almost cost you your life. So tell us about that. What, you saw an advertisement or an appeal?
We had like newspaper once a week on the base, and headquarters was advertising for these positions in Vietnam. But it got to be really bad. It seemed that our higher-ups weren't concerned about the danger that we were in. It was really dangerous. We commuted. I lived in Saigon, but I commuted to Benoit for the Air Force Base to work.
And what kind of work were you doing?
Our job was technical assistant to the Vietnamese Air Force, and one of the officers, you know, we had joint meetings, and what they needed training in was the systems that they had from America. You know, I think all the systems got left, like helicopters and the planes and stuff, and they didn't know how to buy and resupply for them what they needed. And they had end items, which were the big items that could be repaired. And then they had the little items that you throw away, that you repair that end item with. and you figure how much you need for maybe 3 or 4 years down the line when you need to reorder for that time. And, you know, things were moving so fast with the American soldiers over there during the war. They didn't have time for training. The Vietnamese had to learn, and they had a lot of contractors over there that worked with them too. And in our office, they had a lot of Vietnamese ladies who worked. And then we had our office. And when mortar started coming in 3 times a day, we were given flak jackets and helmets to wear at our desk. When we would ride through the marketplace where the car have to stop for the people crossing the street, it's just so slow getting in there because it's so busy, where we easily could have been, you know, explosion stuck to the bus and we wouldn't know it. The driver of the bus getting out of Saigon, he didn't go the same way every day. You know, he changed his routes to get to the highway to go to Myanmar. And one day, I don't know if it was LSI or another contractor had a restaurant on base. They had a truck that they could, if you have to go somewhere on base, you can drive the truck. So I said, let's get the truck and go get a breakfast sandwich. Around 10, you hear the whistling. We dove under some coverage, you know, and it didn't hit the building, it exploded ways out. So the mortar was coming in at 7 before we got there, at 10 and 2. That was in January of 75. So I don't know why they let that go on so long. But I heard, you know, I had some State Department friends, and I could hear things that they were saying. First, we thought it was Ambassador Martin, because we had heard he said he didn't want the Vietnamese to think we were running out on them. I read, that's when it's all over, that President Ford made the decision to put us on the plane and use us as caregivers, like it was civilians for the Navy. I was that because the Navy paid us. And there were State Department employees and there were contractor dependents. We were supposed to be caregivers. I never saw in research and online where they said the caregivers were really civilians or employees or whoever. I was trying to find that I had gotten some medals. I never found it. I saw that the pilot and I think it was the nurse officer who took me upstairs got medals. And I asked the question of how many adults and the names who survived the crash. Couldn't find it. But I found all those who perished and some of my friends I saw.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, Thelma's memories of April 4th, 1975, and the tragic first flight of Operation Babylift. You can link to more information on this chapter of history at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.